I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today, sustainability.
What's the one thing that you hear about when you hear about global warming and climate change? It's those cars out there on the highway, right? So stop driving your Hummer, you know, use better gas, get a Prius. And really, when you look at the numbers, the latest numbers from last year show that buildings emit 46% of the CO2 into the atmosphere. So more than industry and more than all the cars that we've been told to watch out for all these years, it's really those buildings.
In the 70s and 80s, that was the ultimate. If, you know, the bigger the lot you had, and if the lot was big enough to have a swimming pool and then a tennis court and then your own movie theater and then your own cappuccino machine, and all of a sudden you had your own village within your own house. But the problem was all of your neighbors had that too. And so you were totally starved for connectivity and community. A sustainable lifestyle is one that works in community.
What does this building mean to its place? What does it mean to its site? What does it mean to its public front? Everything that we do is with that historical concept in mind, and kind of why did people do things before? They weren't necessarily building buildings, designing buildings with any sort of intent, maybe other than to better the environment. We kind of treat our buildings in that same way. What's something that we can do to give back to the public environment?
Everything is reused.
And designing based on that.
We really like the idea that people think they're beautiful and fabulous and want them first. And oh, by the way, they're made out of repurposed building materials.
My guests today are Paula Vaughn, the co-director of sustainable initiatives at Perkins & Will.
There's the triple bottom line, which says that we incorporate what's best for the environment, what's best for the society, and what's best for the economy, all in one great scenario where these buildings really support all three.
Steve Nygren, a visionary and the developer of Serenby Community.
The incredible side effect is what we think of as sustainability in the material things turns into a more sustainable emotional and physical lifestyle. People come out and they say they're buying a house because they love how beautiful it is, or that we represent all these environmental things, or the fresh air and no pesticides and all sorts of things that they think they're buying. And after they've been there a very short time, they all come and say the best thing is community.
Kevin Clark, a partner with architectural firm Historical Concepts.
Talk about how long does a building stand up. Only as long as it's useful. And if you build a single-use building, it's very hard for that building to accommodate other uses. And what do we already have in place that we can put to good use? And that's the most sustainable thing.
And Lori Sturgis, an artist and sculptor of reusable materials.
We divert a lot of materials from landfills. Hopefully we get it at the deconstruction phase so it's not disgusting, but we're not above dumpster diving on occasion. And I've actually gone out in my church clothes and pulled stuff out of a dumpster before it got back to the yards, because once it gets back in the field, it tends to get a little dirtier.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, sustainability. Sustainability is one of those ideas that we all agree is good, but probably don't all really agree, or maybe even have a real thought about what it means. Often, sustainability is synonymous with green, efficient, safe, environmental, reusable, renewable, or in some cases, just plain expensive. For today's show, we're going to examine the concept of sustainability from four different perspectives: that of the designer, the developer, the architect, and the artist. And while each person rightly advocates for sustainability, they aren't all quite talking about the same thing. Let's begin our discussion with the basics, with the quite literal building blocks of sustainability, the materials themselves.
We do a lot of different types of buildings, including lab buildings, science and technology, K-12 schools, so kindergarten through 12th grade, higher education schools for universities, and a lot of healthcare. And, you know, I think it's with those two segments, with the K-12 buildings and the healthcare buildings, hospitals, that I really started seeing the need for sustainability more than just energy and more than just water use. I don't want to say it's easy to save energy now, but it's a whole lot easier now with the technology in place and the education that's in place to be able to cut energy use and to be able to save water by switching out fixtures. But the part that we also started focusing on is, what is the impact that these buildings have on the people who are not only using them and buying them, but also constructing them. What kind of materials are you using when you build these buildings? Are the materials...
So there's a sustainability of the human life?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And that's what it starts with. It's not just the building product. Is this desk is a solid desk, but what's the laminate on top of the desk and how is that made? And then how is that laminate adhered to the substrate of the desk, to the wood desk? And what is that wood coated with? And all along the chain, we're seeing, there's somebody who's really got to make this stuff. There's somebody who's in the factory or on the job site. So it's not just our building and, the user sitting there at the last final use that we're thinking about. It's how do you make that whole chain?
And when we think about the sustainability of materials, by default, we really have to think about the effect that those materials have on the people that use them, the people who are literally constructing the buildings, and then the people who will live and work within those walls.
For me, I think the moment where it really hit home was working on a medical center in Southeast Alabama, and we were working on the women's floor at the labor and delivery where neonatal intensive care unit was located. So the NICU, and this is where the babies who are premature babies or babies who are born in some sort of risk are kept in their incubators or their cribs or whatever. That's where they spend the first few days of their already fragile lives. So we were designing these rooms and talking about what kind of finishes and calming lights so that there wouldn't be harsh glare and all of that stuff. And then we were thinking about, all right, we'll paint the walls a soft color. Wait, what kind of paint are we going to be using? Is that going to be putting something into the air that's going to be negatively impacting these so fragile babies? What are we putting on the floor? And what are we gluing that down with? So how you make hospitals not just places where you go as a last resort in order to treat something, but a place where you can go, even if you're healthy, to continue to be healthy and to find out how you live to be healthy. So seeing it as a point of contact within the community rather than just the place you go when it's almost too late or the place you go when you're ill.
Sustainability is not merely about materials. It's an issue of lifestyle as well. How we create not only sustainable homes, but a sustainable community of people. And for that, we turn to Steve Nygren, founder of Serenby.
Well, if you look at the beginning of how Serenby happened, I certainly was not what you would consider an environmentalist concerned about sustainability. If you turn back to 91, my wife suggested we do an afternoon drive in the country. And our children were 3, 5, and 7. And so a short drive in the country was the perfect afternoon. And there was a farm, and we couldn't believe there was a farm 20 minutes from the airport because we were so used to urban Atlanta at that point, just 20 years ago. Well, the short story is we fell in love with the farm, we bought it, and it's changed our lives. So in 94, I sold the restaurant company. We sold our house in Ansley Park, and we moved full-time to the rural farm on the edge of Atlanta. And one morning, I was jogging with my daughter along what was then our property line, and there was a bulldozer taking down the forest next to us. And I ran out, and I stopped the guy, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "We've been hired to clear the trees. I guess they're putting houses here. That's what usually happens." And it was just, I was panicked. I soon realized that I could not buy enough land to really protect us. And so what we decided is we needed a much bigger vision. And so we created an organization called the Chattahoochee Hill Country Alliance. And we solicited membership from the landowners in 40,000 acres. This group came together to both educate ourselves and to look at alternatives. We got grants, did a complete master plan. And in 2002, we passed the largest land use change in recent history in metropolitan Atlanta. And the result of that plan demonstrates how we can accommodate 20% more housing per square mile than the development sprawl has done over the last 20 years in metropolitan Atlanta, and at the same time save 70% of the land. Talk about sustainability. We're going to put 20% more housing on 30% of the land. keeping 70% of the land for preserved forests, which helps air quality and recreation, and agriculture.
And how do you do that?
So the key thing is, one, you live in, your houses are clustered into villages. So we have areas for three villages, and these will be anywhere from 2,000 to 8,000 dwelling units. So it would be, the closest example we have in Metro Atlanta, I think, is Decatur. If you can imagine around the town square of Decatur, if most of the buildings around the square were of the six-story that they have some of. And so that would be a lot more dense. What's different is there's a hard edge. So imagine if you were driving from Atlanta down Ponce de Leon to Decatur, and you had a mile and a half of forest or farmland, and you had a hard edge when you left Atlanta, and you had a hard edge when you entered Decatur. And so that's what our master plan calls for. That means chances are you're not going to have lawn. You know, let's grow food in the yards. Let's put natural landscaping in. Let's have the yards smaller. This whole idea that the bigger the house, the better. I'm all for let's build it the same quality. Let's just make it a lot smaller. And you live outside. So it's changing how we think things should be. And what we've done, I think, is common sense and just sensibility. And it amazes me that these common sense issues and a desire to live in some place that's beautiful is so rare that people are coming from all over to see it. Because that's what we did. But we came to it from a naive standpoint, because too many times it's, this can't be done. You know, 10 years ago when I went to the financial community starting talking about what we wanted to do, they thought I was nuts. At about that time, the Rocky Mountain Institute had just published a study on golf course communities. Now, 10 years ago, the banks would back almost any development that had a golf course community. That was just a guarantee because they had the statistics that showed the premiums that any lot facing a golf course would bring. Yet the Rocky Mountain Institute had the study that showed that 94% of the people that owned those lots played golf twice or less a year. So that, to me, was a clear indication they were buying it for the green space, not to be on a golf course. Well, that sounded logical to the financial community, but we didn't have any statistics. There were no feasibility studies showing that people would pay more for a forest or to back up to an organic farm or pasture with animals. And so that was one of the early things I realized is we needed to be a model to start building the statistics to show that people would pay a premium to back up to these natural things. And what we're doing at Serenbee and the Chattahoochee Hill Country and other places like us around the country, we're just a petri dish. We're an example, but we are a studied, that this can't be an accident. This wasn't something that I woke up a morning and saw. This was something that I went along with buying the farm, and then I watched the difference it had on our children. And that was something I certainly wanted, and then I wanted to share it with people I cared about. And so that's how that sort of evolved. It wasn't some intellectual decision. It was watching it.
That was Steve Nygren, the developer of Serenbee Community. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Sustainability, brought to you by Perkins & Will. We often think about sustainability as something that we have to become. We need new technologies. We need new ideas. We need new buildings. Well, our next guest actually says something quite opposite. For him, new is not sustainable. As Kevin Clark likes to say, buildings are not good because they're old.
It's old because it's good. Traditional architecture really, really was the original sustainability. And if you think about sustainability, I guess in the concept that it's not lifelong, it's an eternal thing. It's something that is going to either replenish itself, which buildings don't do, or it's going to be something that you put in the ground and that it is going to stand forever. That's, they call Rome the eternal city, right? And we've walked in buildings that are 2,000 years old. That's unfathomable in America, certainly in Atlanta. You know, I guess Rome didn't have Sherman, but maybe they, you know, that's why I get jazzed about traditional architecture, because I think if you design a building that people are truly going to love, they're going to keep it around for generations. It's a cultural thing. You know, you have to build something with the understanding or the hope that it's going to last a long time. And actually, that's something that developers and architects may not be doing a good job of. I heard an architect tell me while I was in college. He said, "Oh yeah, we pretty much figure that every building we do is going to be torn down in 25 years." Oh man, what? I wouldn't even want to be an architect if that was what I thought everybody felt. But I do think that developers and architects alike, they kind of look at, you know, what's that short-term return, and someone prettier is going to come along, something better is going to come along in 20, 25 years. That building's going to outlast itself. And part of the onus is on the city. And this is not Atlanta. This is everywhere. They, I'm trying to think of the right word here. You know, they basically incentivize people to tear buildings down. And that sounds really, really funny. But if I have a building, and there was a case on this just down the street here on Spring Street, the Kerman Forster building, you know, the owners of the people who had bought that property decided they wanted to tear it down and put a parking lot. Well, the reality is they didn't actually need more parking. It's that that building sitting empty cost them a lot of money because they were paying property taxes based on this high value building, a very beautiful classical old building. And that's where I say the city is incentivizing people to tear things down, because the zoning, you know, really in downtown and along Peachtree, pretty much tells everybody that the value of your land is a skyscraper. And that's why you end up with all these one-story buildings or vacant lots, is because the owner of that vacant lot or one-story building is just waiting for, I hate to say Donald Trump, but, you know, some big-time developer to come in and say, "I'm going to put $500 million, half a billion dollar project down here, and I'm going to pay you the value that that essentially the zoning has put into place." So I think that, you know, one of the things the city could do from a sustainability standpoint is actually really downzone everything. So if you just imagine a 9-block area, and let's say there's going to be 1,000 people in this 9-block area, you can have 8 vacant blocks and one skyscraper on one block with those 1,000 people in it. Or you can have, you know, 9 kind of equally spaced block, you know, equally heighted and distributed blocks with those 1,000 people distributed around. What's a better streetscape? What's a better city?
We've had that discussion a lot in Atlanta about how you build for appropriateness. So do you build a building that's a 50-year building? Do you build a building that's a 10-year building? It's a matter of determining what the need is. We see a lot of clients who still do want those very sturdy, formidable buildings because they're meant to stay. But then other clients who admit, "I'm only going to be here for a couple of years, let's do something quick and then plan for reuse." So demountable partitions, carpet that can be taken up and repurposed or sent back to the manufacturer. But if you think about the buildings, what do you do with the concrete? You know, what do you do with the glass that comes out of the building and the steel that comes out of the building? Can you plan them going into it when you're designing? Can you plan for aftermarket life or end-of-life use? So how do you deconstruct these buildings so that they don't go to the landfill?
We get a phone call saying, you know, "We're taking over a building. We're trying to go for LEED Platinum, and we have to repurpose everything that we can, and we wondered if you wanted to come through here and take a look."
We're going to conclude today with the art of using reusable objects and materials, and that's where Lori Sturgis comes in.
This just kind of grew out of a notion that so much stuff is getting dumped into landfills that has, I think, still another life. And the idea behind that is, in companies that have their headquarters here, we would build sculpture out of their materials, out of their branded products, out of their leftovers, out of their recyclables. It lends itself to a lot of other public art installations too, like we're doing something down at Colony Square right now. It's an ongoing project that everybody that's eating at the food court can donate their recycled bottles and cans into the tree that we started building on Earth Day.
It's kind of interesting. So like, they take what otherwise would be trash and they're throwing it into something that becomes art.
Yeah. Now, it's a cliche. Doing a tree on Earth Day or Arbor Day is pretty much a cliche, but we did it as an exercise to just demonstrate how simple it is to look at things in a very different way. It was a very interesting experience. I didn't think it would be traumatic, but there were parts of it that were to me, because this gal had tried to get this thing to anybody who might want the piano. It had long since stopped playing well. They couldn't tune it. It was just past its usefulness as far as being a piano, but I saw such beauty in the parts of it, the keys and the carved bits and the just the old wood. The harp is amazing. It's outrageously heavy, and it's inside the back. This was a vertical piano, and we showed up at this little house in Min Park just ready to dismantle it, and we rolled it out on the front porch, and the gal was real sweet and gave us cookies and, you know, just said, oh, this will be fun. Well, as the visible contents of the piano are starting to be put in other parts, and you could see that things were being taken off it, it became a real emotional thing for Glenn and I and for the owner, as she would come out on the porch and just kind of glance. And there were comments, and then there were times when there was nothing at all, but she would just come out and just kind of sigh or something. I mean, I was so cognizant of how she must have felt as she was seeing this thing being taken apart. And when it came time to cut the strings on the front of the piano, we had the front of it opened up, and we were able to get these shears in there and cut the individual wires. Every single one of them gave the sound of the key as it was being cut. And it was just so weird to have that be a part of this dismantling. I didn't realize at the time, as much as I love piano music, how much the instrument would be making noise to us as we were taking it apart. And I'm just very respectful of the artisans that put the piano together in the first place, and the people that sold it, that bought it, that played it their whole lives, and now for us to be able to use all those pieces in the creation of artwork and have other musicians look at those pieces and recognize them and react in a very cool, emotional way is the best. It's exactly what we want.
You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. I want to thank our guests today, Paula Vaughn, Steve Nygren, Kevin Clark, and Lori Sturgis. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will, recently named the number one architecture firm in the country by Architect Magazine. Thanks for listening. See you next month.